When was the last time you heard a line from a treasured poem running through your mind? During a moment of beauty or frustration, or perhaps just when you needed an escape? That happens to me sometimes, when I'm lying awake at night getting anxious about something, because why else are you lying awake at night? I remind myself of what Lawrence Ferlinghetti told me. We think differently at night, and that keeps me calm, usually, until the light of day. Or when I step away from something important to take a break or do something that's important in some other way, I'll hear Tony Hoagland telling me that part of my responsibility on this planet belongs to joy. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're going to hear about a poetry contest not for writers, but for readers. It started in Poland, and it's found its way to Kansas. Mark Ulig is a journalist. He worked as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times from 1988 to 1991, and now he runs a publishing company in Overland Park. He's bringing the contest to Kansas. Hi, Mark.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
So explain this contest to me. It's called Poetry Unites, right?
It's called Poetry Unites Kansas, and it's a combination of an essay contest and a documentary film project, because the winners of the essay contest become the subject of these documentary films. And it's something that's been done with great success in Europe.
What are the essays?
The essays are from anyone. We invite anyone in Kansas to write about the influence of a poem, their favorite poem, on their life. It doesn't have to be profound, but it needs to reflect their thinking in their life. And it's a 600, there's no form to the essay, 600 words, and just describing the importance of that poem in their life. We then give those entries to a very distinguished panel of judges, including wonderful nationally recognized poets and writers, and as well as Kansas literary figures, and they choose the subjects for these documentaries. Then we make the documentaries based on that.
So it doesn't sound like competition is entirely the point.
Not at all. Not at all. This is about to describe and explore the importance that poetry has in the life of everyday life of Kansans. I hesitate to say of ordinary Kansans, because I think when you see the results, I am guessing that you will not think of them as ordinary Kansans anymore.
How many entries do you expect to get? I mean, I think, as you can tell by the way I began this discussion, I care about poetry. I'm not sure that that's like a really super popular opinion.
I think it might depend on the type of poet that you're reading. I think everybody has some lines that they remember and they have learned at some point in their life that they think about when life is difficult or possibly when life is good. And so it's really about asking them, inviting them to tell about the way that poetry interacts with their life.
What made you want to bring this particular thing to Kansas? I mean, it started in Eastern Europe, and we're going to get the story on that. But I mean, you want to bring this specific contest to this place at this particular moment in time. And I have to imagine there's a reason. I mean, you could start a poetry contest yourself on your own. It didn't have to be this one, and it didn't have to be right now.
Well, first of all, the quality of the filmmaking and the quality of this competition is spectacular. It is I think one of the most extraordinary initiatives that I've seen in this area, and the filmmakers involved, Ava Zizinska, and the team of filmmakers that work on it are extraordinary. The results in Europe have been extraordinary, and I think if you go to the website, the poetryunites.com website, and you look at some of the videos that have been made from Europe, I think you'll quickly understand how powerful this is. And so rather than start again, we took the very best throughout the world and brought it to Kansas in the hope of sort of creating a new dimension to the public dialogue and elevating the dialogue a little bit. Because when you talk about art, you necessarily elevate the dialogue and the public dialogue, and you end up emphasizing universal ideas that we all share, or thoughts that we all share.
Well, I'm going to get back to you, but But we've got the founder of Poetry Unites on the line with us. Ewa Zajinska is a Polish filmmaker. Good morning, Ewa. Thanks for joining us.
And good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Tell me about yourself, first of all. You grew up in Poland, right?
I grew up in Poland, but I emigrated to the States, 30 years ago. So basically, I am American citizen, and now I've been living here.
What's your relationship with poetry personally?
You know, I never wrote poetry. I always was a reader, and it really helped me a lot, especially with difficult situations. It gives me a certain perspective.
Can you give an example?
Well, it's a very personal example. I would like to, maybe another time, if you don't mind.
Another time later in this conversation, or just when we're not on the radio?
Maybe when we are not on the radio. However, the one thing that occurred to me, that this contest is very timely now in the States. You started your show with politics, and I really believe that poetry unites and politics divide. And actually, the whole program started with the idea. It started in Poland, but it was sponsored by a Belgian foundation. And the whole idea was to integrate new European countries. And the poetry was treated as an instrument of mutual understanding. Well, I think the integration of Europe didn't happen so perfectly as we hoped it would. However, the group of people I filmed, they met together, they stayed together, and they were wonderful people, and they had very personal and intimate stories about their favorite poems and about their lives. I learn a lot. I learn a lot about Europe, about people from little villages in Poland.
Is it by reading the essays people write about their favorite poems?
Exactly, and by meeting them also and interviewing them. But also through the essay you could get a fantastic picture of this intimate, very often shy people. And people tend to open up more when they talk about their favorite poem. Maybe that's why I didn't want to open up too much today. Sorry. Refusing to talk about my favorite poem.
No, there are days that feel like that. What is the real idea of this contest for you? I mean, you've talked about it a little bit, but what made you want to start this, especially as a person who isn't a poet? When you think of someone who's inspired to start a poetry contest, you might expect that person to be a poet.
You know, but I was more interested in people's lives, in history. I am really very interested in the situation, what changes your life or what influences your life that you make the right decision. And very often a poem can be very important and can be this element that will influence you and your life in the right way. It will help you to make the right decision.
So we aren't going to do an example from your life because it's personal, but I know that you've interviewed and filmed all these people talking about their favorite poems and the essays they've written about them and how they've shaped their lives. Can you give me some examples from those things, things that have moved you, stories that have changed how you have thought about other human beings?
You know, the very first letter which I received, when in the beginning it was a program that public television was broadcasting the films every Saturday morning in Poland, and I got a letter, my very first letter I got from a girl, 19-year-old girl from a little village in Poland, who wrote about a poem by Elizabeth Bishop, One Art. And it starts, "Art of losing isn't hard to master."
The art of losing isn't hard to master.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. And actually, this is one of my favorite poems. And I was incredibly moved that someone from a little village I never heard of has so much to do with me and with my emotional life. And anyway, this girl, this poem changed her life. She decided to study American literature. And right now she teaches English as a second language in Indiana University. She's doing her PhD from this little village. She came to the States, and we are in touch. So this poem really changed her life. She learned English. She doesn't have such a heavy accent as I do, I must say.
Your accent is lovely.
Oh, thank you very much. I like to hear it. And this is this example. And of course, she knew everything about Elizabeth Bishop. And she's a very, very nice person. And you know what's funny? Nobody at her family read. She was a daughter of farmers, but her grandmother started to run a library as a business in this little village. So they would receive a lot of books, new books. And the grandmother left her and her older brother among books. So she started to read by herself when she was 5. And then one day she found this poem in this library. So this is a very touchy story to me, and it's a pure coincidence. Her grandmother wasn't a reader. Her parents were not readers. Just a pure coincidence,
you know,
that she was exposed to books and then this poem.
Now that, I mean, you're in the United States and you're an American, and it's interesting to me that this contest that you started, that it started in Eastern Europe. I mean, does poetry fill a different role in Eastern Europe than it fills here? Do you see a difference either just in the way it's integrated into civic life or something?
You know, it depends, because poetry is big in Poland, and it's historically big, because in 19th century, when Poland didn't exist, we had our language, we had our poetry, we had our big poets like Adam Mickiewicz, Słowacki, Norwid, and all these three big names, they kept nation alive. And I guess we can say that poetry is big in Poland, especially that we have two recent Nobel Prize winners, Wisława Szymborska and Czesław Miłosz, who was also American citizen. They got Nobel within the last 20 years.
But what do you mean when you say they kept the nation alive?
What I mean, the language. As long as language is alive, and when people are reading, they were read, they kept, they had, there was a hope. There was a hope. As long as there is poetry, there is a hope. And this is what was happening in 19th century in Poland.
It sounds like you've got a little bit of a siren in the background there. You're in New York, right?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No,
yes.
No, I'm just helping our listeners understand what they're hearing there, so they're not pulling over in traffic.
Yes, that's right. And you know, it was so quiet an hour ago.
Of course.
I don't know what's going on.
Well, you know, Mark Ulig, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, as someone who's been as a journalist, a foreign correspondent, do you have the sense that poetry fills a different role in other parts of the world, maybe particularly in Eastern Europe, than it has tended to fill in America?
Well, I think that's the question we're looking to address, because I'm not sure that it does, because I don't think it has been discussed as widely in the United States. And I think it's the point of bringing this project here is to explore that and explore what it means to average people. And one of the...
Rather than making an assumption.
Yeah, I think we make an assumption that nothing... And it's difficult in a state like Kansas. Geographically, it's difficult for people to come together and discuss this. If you talk to people from the cultural organizations that are very involved in poetry readings, et cetera, throughout the state, I think they're surprised by how much participation there is. I don't doubt at all that the life of the mind in Kansas is as active or more active than it is anywhere else in the world. And, you know, one of my old editors always used to say that the one rule of being a journalist is to remember to ask the question. And so in this case, we're asking the question. We're inviting people to tell us the answer. We're inviting everyone to participate and tell us what poetry means to them. And so we're trying to come without preconceptions and be open to learn about what's happening in Kansas.
Mark, I want to hear more from Ava in a second, but what interests you about her story, or about the story of this filmmaker from Poland now living in New York starting this contest, which in some ways is more than a contest, a way of gathering information, gathering stories about the role of poetry in people's lives.
Well, I think one of the things that's, I was a Russian studies student and lived in Leningrad in the Cold War, and went to school at Leningrad. And one of the things that always impressed me was how much was really going on that wasn't visible and wasn't public, because it was impossible for it to be public. You would, through your friends in the university, you would know and meet in these private groups and know what's going on. I think Ava's experience from Poland is very much that, where she was able to reach those communities and reach that level of thinking. And I think she's drawn it out extremely well, not just in Poland, but in Bulgaria, in Germany, even in New York State, because this has been brought to New York State, and the results are spectacular. Like I say, if you look at the videos that have been created, you'll see exactly why it will be interesting to see what we get here.
Ava, Mark has talked about just you being in a position to draw stories out of people in a situation where publicly proclaiming the love of a poem, or that might not be a totally, that might be a very different setting to do it. I'm interested in hearing about that from you.
Well, that's why I find this project so exciting. I am really open, excited and happy that it's happening, and I will see the we'll learn more about the state, which is exactly in the middle of the USA. And you know, I always was interested in people's lives. I grew up in Warsaw, and we used to have this huge courtyard that was probably 50 children were playing always. And I was always among people. And thanks to this project, I am still surrounded by very different people from different professions, different ages. It was true at my courtyard in Warsaw, because this was like in Poland, there was children of professors, of workers. My best friend was a daughter of a waiter, and another was, her father was a famous professor.
So everyone mixed together.
Exactly. And this was like, I guess this was my childhood. And yet it was fantastic to grow up among people. And now I am meeting through this project. You know, the youngest person was 6 years old, the oldest 94. Yeah. And I made films of a housekeeper, cleaning lady, a handyman, a truck driver. Also,
Ava, I'm sorry to jump in. I have one last question for you, and that is we're going to be talking shortly about the role of artists and the arts in a political ecosystem. And right now, I feel like people around here are either very energized and activated by politics or else overwhelmed by politics and trying to wrap their minds around all kinds of things. Is there a role for poetry in helping not just artists, but everyone navigate this kind of situation?
I believe, yes, very much so. As I said, poetry unites, politics divide, and that's why we all should read poetry and find a poem.
Thank you so much, Ava Zazinska and Mark Ulig, for talking with me today.
Our pleasure.
We'll put a link.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Ava. We'll put a link to the information about Poetry Unites on our website. And when we return, the role of artists in a political world. Should art be political? Can it be anything else? We'd like to hear your take. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. On Inauguration Day, the rock band Chris Meck and the Guilty Birds released a new song. Chris has been a guitar player in lots of local bands, but he started his own band just last year, and the band's first album was about love and death. This new song, perhaps unexpectedly, is about something different. Politics. And he wrote it before the election.
I was running errands and listening to the radio in the car, and it was just sort of song after song of just sort of bland, vaguely happy stuff. You know, it's like a synth pop bands that sound like it's 1984 and they're the Thompson Twins, only their song's not very good. And, you know, a little sensitive acoustic songwriter guy that, and literally the chorus was something about butterflies. And it occurred to me that, you know, I don't know why these kids aren't angry. Their futures were bought and sold by their parents and grandparents, and they're not angry. You know, where's the MC5? Where's Bob Dylan? Not 75-year-old Bob Dylan, but where's the 22-year-old Bob Dylan? So I wrote an angry song.
Say a prayer for the soul of a fractured nation. A house divided, split by lies and manipulation.
I just wrote a very simple minor key, crunchy guitar riff that's just sort of very repetitive and driving. And then out of that, I just came up with a equally insistent and repetitive sort of rhyme scheme where every single line is a rhyme.
A black republic in the service of the corporation. Lit high and dry by the legislated exploitation.
I really didn't want it to be necessarily artful or flowery in any way. I really just wanted to be as direct and straightforward as possible, and then do it very loud and very hard.
Can't drink the water on account of the contamination. It puts the oil on the soil of the reservation.
Calandra Izquierdo plays bass and sings harmony, and then Michelle Bacon plays drums and sings harmony. Girls really like the rock stuff. They're a lot of times less excited when it's like some sort of like tender ballad sort of thing. They like to turn it up and rock, so they loved it.
Paid thugs shoot slugs into the demonstration.
I guess because there were a lot of different things I wanted to touch on, it almost kind of has to be like soundbite, because there are a lot of things that I thought were worthy of mention. And I'm probably not going to write a whole record full of political songs about each separate issue that something that bothers me. I mean, maybe, but probably not. I kind of just wanted to kind of spew it all out in my one little 3-minute block and then get on with my life. I'm certainly not afraid of being political or having a political statement. I kind of think that's part of your job as an artist to comment and reflect things that are going on around you. I'm not very optimistic. We've kind of taken this thing in such a direction that I kind of think that like maybe the best case scenario for the next 4 years is going to be that we don't nuke anybody and nobody nukes us, and then maybe we get some good rock and roll out of it.
That was Chris Meck of Chris Meck and the Guilty Birds, and a story of a song produced by KCUR's CJ Janovy. We've got a video of their new song, Destination Revolution, at kcur.org/arts. So what do you think? Is it an artist's job to comment on what's going on? Do artists have a responsibility to respond in some way to politics? And if so, what is that responsibility exactly? Is it to influence electoral outcomes? Is there some other way that artists are contributing to politics? 816-235-2888. Dave Lowenstein, I want to start with you. Dave is a painter and muralist. He's been here before to talk about some of his big mural projects in Lawrence. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good to be here.
You are involved in something right now called the U.S. Department of Arts and Culture, but this is not an actual U.S. State Department.
It is not a federal agency.
No. Talk to me about that.
The U.S. Department of Arts and Culture is a network affiliation of artists who are working at the sort of confluence of art and social justice. It's been around for about 3 years. We're leading up in the next couple of weeks to our big national event, which is called the People's State of the Union.
What is that?
The People's State of the Union is sort of a reframing of what we know of as the President's State of the Union, which is a monologue from the president down to us about how he or she feels about the current state of affairs.
In this case, he.
In this case, he. But the People's State of the Union is a dialogue. It's where we talk to each other about not just the State of the Union nationwide, but the State of the Union in our own neighborhoods and cities and within a state like Kansas or Missouri.
So how does that work? I mean, a monologue version of the State of the Union involves a person at a podium with a microphone and a whole broadcast apparatus. How do a bunch of people have a dialogue that reaches somewhere?
Right. Well, what's happening is across the country in communities large and small, people will be gathering between January 27th and February 5th to meet and story circles is what we call them. They're usually groups of about 8 people at a time. They'll be given a few prompts about times that they felt a sense of belonging or disbelonging within the current state of affairs. And each person in the group gets a couple of minutes to share their story without talk back or questioning. And then afterwards, that group will reflect on the similarities and differences, aspirations and challenges that arose. And then the whole group within, you know, in our case, it's going to be the Lawrence Public Library, will talk about, well, what do we want to do with what we learned from our stories today?
So have you always seen art and politics as having a relationship, or is this something that you're inspired to do just now? Anew.
No, this has been part of my practice for as long as I can remember. And I don't really connect it, you know, in sort of art and politics. I see myself as, you know, having to be a responsible citizen and using the tools, skills, and experience I have to address the things that are not only important to me, but that I'm implicated in. And, you know, I was listening to the song before, and I really like the song, and I think it's great that, you know, things like that are being made. But there was a comment towards the end where the artist was saying, you know, I want to make this one song get on with my life. But a lot of people in the U.S. right now don't have that opportunity. They are going to be facing challenges, oppression, I unfortunately imagine, that others may not have to think about.
Do you think, when you talk about a dialogue sort of as a counterpoint to the monologue that is the State of the Union delivered by a president, do you think that it's going to be truly a dialogue as in representing many points of view? Or do you think that it's more many experiences around a pretty similar point of view? I mean, I think that's a kind of a struggle sometimes in art circles.
Sure. And I think we have to start with what we have, you know, gather in public spaces, people of free will getting together to share stories. We may not have every opinion represented at the beginning, but I think the important thing is to share those individual stories and begin to have them be in the public realm so that we're not just responding to what's coming from our elected representatives or others in the media.
So then what is the goal of political artwork? I think there's been a lot of talk about this, especially in the wake of someone like Meryl Streep giving her perspective during the Golden Globes, or the cast of Hamilton trying to tell Mike Pence what they feel and what their concerns are during a performance. There is a lot of question about not whether they should be political, but what is it they're trying to accomplish?
I think there are lots of different goals for making statements as an artist. And you mentioned two that are sort of different in a way. Meryl Streep was speaking as a citizen who had a platform to talk about the things she cared about, where the cast of Hamilton was actually performing a play that was highly political in its own conception. For me and others that I know, we think deeply about audience, like who this work we're creating is for. Is it to influence others and perhaps try to change minds? That's one avenue. Or is it to support those who are struggling at this moment to change things and be in solidarity with them? And I think for artists of all stripes and all media, that's a really important consideration.
Grace Chin is with us. She's also an artist. Hi, Grace.
Hello.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So you create, well, why don't I let you describe your own art, and then we'll pick up with this conversation about the relationship between politics and art.
Well, my practice ranges through several different kinds of media, but mainly I've been working with paper sculpture, making wreaths out of paper that look like floral wreaths, and then I also make prints and drawings.
And these wreaths, they have text in them.
Yes.
That I would say the context, you know, they're often feminist messages.
Yes.
Can you give a couple of examples?
Smash the patriarchy, all bodies are good bodies.
I'm looking at one that says, a witch bows to no man.
Yeah. Some of them are a little tongue-in-cheek. But yeah, feminist messages.
I'm curious about your perspective on the events over the weekend and whether you participated in any way, as a civilian or as an artist, or not that these are separate things.
This weekend, unfortunately, I wasn't able to participate in the Women's March, but a lot of work that I've been trying to make has been in response to the aftermath of the election. And
like what has changed for you in terms of how you create art, the messages you put out?
Well, I work a lot on commission, but I've been trying to subvert some of the messages that people give to me and apply them to use those as a starting off point to talk about current events.
Can you give me an example?
Well, the most recent one is probably not appropriate to say on the air.
Okay.
That's the one that comes to mind right now. But
Well, okay. So recognizing that it's not appropriate to say on the air. Maybe I'll start with that, because what does a message that maybe isn't appropriate to say on the air, what What works about that, and what are maybe the limitations of that as a message? I mean, what do you do with a message that isn't appropriate to state on the air? You know what
well,
I mean?
The one I was thinking of was the gist of it was to try to mess things up. I guess that's a paraphrasing of it that's appropriate for the air. But the person who commissioned it, their partner is a social worker, and he said that's what he wants to do, is to like basically not be compliant. And I think that's really relevant to what a lot of people are feeling right now, is to not be so compliant and to resist. And
what does putting a message out there in strong terms, what do you think that adds?
Well, I really believe that there is no idea so complicated that you can't say it in plain language. Making objects that people put in their homes and see every day, I think, is a political act. I want to clarify that I don't think you need to simplify the idea, but you can simplify the language you use.
What do you think, in a perfect world, an artist... What do you think an artist's job would be?
That's in a perfect world.
To
expand human experience, I suppose is like any artist's wish.
Well, we're going to get right back. We're going to hear what a professor of printmaking has to say about this, having met a lot of different students and with his own practice as well. Plus, we've got some callers. You can join them, 816-235-2888, to comment about the artist's role in a political world. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Dave Lowenstein and Grace Chin, two artists who have been talking to me about what they see as the artist's role in a political world. They've been telling me their own stories about how, especially the recent election and inauguration, have either mobilized them or shifted their approach. And I'd like to bring Michael Krieger into the conversation. He's a KU professor of printmaking. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
So how long have you been teaching at KU?
This will be my 22nd year.
So that's a lot of students through a few different presidencies. And I'm curious about whether you've seen, young artists' feelings and approaches to this kind of topic kind of ebb and flow and change over the course of that time.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's changed a great deal. I mean, you're dealing with an age group also that's pretty much stays the same as the professor's age. and you see that kind of fervency of youth that's excited about what's happening in their time and interest in expressing their ideas about that. It's been pretty consistent, I think.
What about with the art world in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true as well, that there's been a kind of constant thread of work that addresses politics. But, you know, in some ways, I think that all art is political. I mean, even if it's a kind of bucolic scene or if it's a landscape or whatever, I think that the choices that an artist makes to serve that role in society is a political choice in many ways, to be sort of at that last outpost of unabashed thinking and radical ideas in many ways, even if that means that their process is just carefully arranging things or being delicate with the drawing to express those kinds of deep emotional feelings through a work of art, and be willing to share and be generous in that sharing, I think is a much valued sort of point of view, and exists also in the political landscape.
I want to get back to you to hear about your own approach as an artist yourself, but we've got a caller who I want to hear from. Sarah in Kansas City, Kansas, called 816-235-2888. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Tell us your story. What's your relationship to all of this?
Yeah, well, I do. I've been doing open mic comedy in Kansas City for about maybe a year and a half, possibly approaching on 2 years. And so what's my role when I do that? You know, art. I think pretty much telling my story. You know, so really, you know, it's not necessarily my job to talk about politics or any particular stand-up's job to do that. But you know, if in so much as politics is personal. I didn't realize that, I guess probably I did get an opportunity to go to the Women's March in Kansas City on Saturday, and it was wonderful, very well organized and put on. And the speeches were well done and beautiful because they were just people talking about their stories. And that's very harrowing, getting to hear, you know, and even for a 3 minute period of time, putting yourself in someone else's shoes. So I just thought that was extremely inspirational and motivational and very well put on and done. I guess bottom line is, for me and my perspective, there just aren't enough female voices in comedy. While I've been on hold, I've been trying to make a comprehensive as I can, list of all of the women that I know that do comedy in Kansas City. And so far I'm up to 11 out of, and myself being one in that list. And there's got to be like at least 50, probably more, folks that regularly do the, you know, open mic circuit here in Kansas City.
So could you do a little connecting the dots for me there? I mean, why do you think that that is an important thing to bring up when we talk about art and political art especially?
Well, I mean, yeah, great question. I mean, if you think about it, it's like, so my reaction, I self-identify as a feminist, but there's lots of people. I mean, even on this list of people that I've made of, you know, women that I know and I see on a regular basis and who are very funny and do excellent stand-up, you know, not everybody self-identifies as a feminist, and nobody should or has to, or it's their job to. But, you know, so my reaction when I get up on stage and how, you know, Trump hits me, you know, what the joke that I'm going to make in response to grab him by the pussy, you know, is not necessarily the same joke that my male counterpart would make. Somebody who's my same age, comes from my same socioeconomic background, et cetera. That is going to hit us differently. Even other language like locker room talk is going to hit folks. One of my more popular jokes, I guess I could share, is I don't know if you can tell by looking at me, I didn't do a lot of sports growing up. I'm overweight. So this is a joke I talk about, and that gets a laugh. And I go, well, I did win a participation award once. It was for my church's purity group, which is kind of a joke about not getting laid in high school, right? about being overweight and not getting laid in high school. So I guess, yeah, just more female voices reacting to our people in power around us, you know, so Trump being the president, or okay, Mike Pence, you know, yeah. More queer voices reacting to, you know, his position on conversion therapy.
So we're talking, we're talking sort of generally about representation. I mean, I'm curious with the people around the table here about what other kinds of, if artists are a big part of communicating, at least communicating how people feel about politics, whether What about representation? I mean, are there other than gender, are there other kinds of representation that you feel are missing?
Well, sure. I want to connect a couple of points to the caller's work, you know, with the stand-up and comedians. She made me remember the work of the Guerrilla Girls. The Guerrilla Girls is this anonymous group of women who for, you know, 25 years have been making posters and making performances that highlight inequities like our caller was talking about, especially with women's representation in museums. And it made me also think about a real motivating quote from a writer activist who I deeply admire, James Baldwin, who said, "The purpose of art is to lay bare the questions that have been hidden by the answers." And I think that's one role that an artist can have in a time like this.
Grace, what do you think?
Yeah, definitely. I think, folks of color and trans folks and lots of marginalized communities ought to be represented, because part of the artist's job is to well, like I was saying earlier, expand human experience and understanding. And
do you think that conservatives' voices are represented within the arts?
Yeah, you know, I'm certain they are. I'm like a little less familiar with what's happening in contemporary art with conservative voices. I don't know if anybody else here has any perspective on that, but
I think it's rare. And partially, I think, because artists are so deeply involved with empathy. And to have that point of view that a lot of conservatives have, you can't deal with empathy in the same sort of way.
That's a pretty strong indictment.
It is. And that's what, I mean, artists are engaged in mining empathy and trying to express that to a culture and at a cost to their own, perseverance in a way. And when faced with that empathy, you have to make choices about your own morality or the policies that you stand behind.
Michael, what has been your own relationship to exploring politics within your art?
You know, I haven't. I think that for the most part, it's not super overt in my work. In some older work, I dealt with a kind of overturning of American history. It's a revisionist takes on American history.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I did some work on Jefferson and sort of upended some of the myths about him in terms of his leanings in politics and stuff like that. So I became very interested in Howard Zinn and other writers and stuff who have kind of taken revisionist takes on history. And that gave me a way to talk about contemporary issues without it being super topical.
What does that do for you? I mean, is there something that you are relieved of without having to be topical about today's issues?
I guess it does kind of free you up to maneuver into different areas without being tied to, precisely what's happening now. It just hasn't been a particular interest of mine to deal with topical issues, and I like work that does, but for my own work, I think it hasn't done that.
But when you said earlier that you think that all art is political, what did you mean by that in that case? I mean,
well, I guess I mean that the role the artist plays in society is without their own choosing, perhaps, or perhaps it is their own choosing, is a political point of view, because we do exist on the margins and the fringes, and the activities and the things that we're up to are rarefied in our culture. But at the same time, artists drive culture. We end up inserting ourselves into the political landscape all the time with what we do. And that may be very directly or overtly with work that is topical, or it may be just because of our existence. And, things like, my whole adult life and when I was a young artist in college, the arts have been under attack in my lifetime from Jesse Helms and the NEA artists that were attacked in that time period. And so my choice to become an artist in face of that was a political choice in many ways, right? I mean, when Brownback came into office and immediately eliminated the Arts Commission, and you're a young artist and you're saying, I want to be an artist. Well, then that choice becomes political.
What do you think about that, Dave Lowenstein? I see you nodding.
Yeah, well, I think this speaks to the power of art. I mean, if you look at oppressive regimes throughout history, one of the first groups they try to silence and censor are artists and culture makers. And we're seeing that already here with the new Trump administration. There's a call out to get rid of the National Endowment for Humanities and National Endowment for the Arts.
Do you think there's anything particular about this being in Kansas?
Probably.
Probably so.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll have to explore what that is at a later date. But Dave Lowenstein, thanks so much for joining me.
Absolutely.
And Grace Chin, it's been a real joy meeting you.
Thank you.
Michael Krieger, thanks for coming in from KU to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
And that's a wrap for today's show. We'll have it online for you to listen to, both of our conversations, at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can check that out later today, and you can subscribe to our podcast while you're there, and you'll catch every episode that way. The show is over, but you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at Gina KCUR. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about the movie The Founder. It's based on the true story behind the history of McDonald's, and we'll be hearing from some local people who have roles in that story, from working at McDonald's to founding Winstead's. Give us a listen tomorrow at 10. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Caitlin Troutman. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.